weapon.
We have all eternity to accomplish our mission.
Does not destroy.
Captain, there's a spatial distortion heading toward us.
It erases.
All organisms and man-made objects have been eradicated.
Now, Voyager gets caught in the crossfire.
All hands brace for impact.
Can a device that alters time ever be destroyed?
He's trying to erase us from history.
On the next Star Trek Voyager.
Transfer complete.
Hello and welcome to Subspace Transmissions, the podcast where two Trek fans step into the arena and tackle the best, worst, weirdest, wildest, and everything in between that Star Trek has to offer. I'm Cam Smith, and joining me on the bridge...
This is Tyler Orton, brushing up on his Earth history.
And coming out of temporal flux, Janine Smith.
Heyo!
Welcome back, Janine. Now, we want to have you on this week. We're going to talk about the Voyager two-parter, Year of Hell. It's a very big deal, I think, for Voyager fans. And the first time you were on an episode we did called The Beginner's Guide to Star Trek, where we exposed you to two episodes from each Star Trek series and asked you to pick your favorites. And it was sort of a contest between Tyler and I.
Who won, Cam?
You should check that episode out if you haven't listened to it. You can find... We don't want to spoil it for those
Yeah, you can find out who won, who maybe knows Janine best.
Yeah.
By the way, how do you guys know each other?
She's my sister.
Okay. Interesting.
But it's a very fun episode. But anyway, when we did that episode, you responded the most to the Voyager cast. What was it about Voyager that jumped out to you among, you know, the pack of obviously Enterprise and Deep Space Nine?
It was definitely Janeway.
Mm-hmm.
For sure. I really enjoyed I felt familiar with that character because of Orange is the New Black and her playing on that. I just enjoyed her presence. She felt the most competent to me. But also it was probably the series that I had the least amount of questions about.
Right.
Like you understood the
I mean, if you listen to that episode, I was clearly very confused about some simple things.
Like the holographic doctor?
You're like, whoa, whoa, whoa.
Yeah.
They're in space?
I was like, they're lost? And I think the doctor's a hologram? Yeah. So in hindsight, I didn't really understand, but on watching it, I felt like...
Right. Now... I thought it would be a good idea to have you on for this Year of Hell episode because Year of Hell is somewhat of a standalone, and it may be arguably one of the best Janeway two-parters ever, or Janeway episodes, and for, I think, a lot of fans. And so why don't we dive into it? I guess, you know, before we get to you, Janine, you know, Tyler, you saw Year of Hell way back in the day in the glorious year of, was it 98, 99?
I think it was 97.
97, okay. Is that why the Titanic reference was in there?
No, wasn't that 98?
Titanic came out in 97.
Oh, okay.
My apologies. December of 97.
Must have been why there's the Titanic reference. There's the reference to Captain Nemo.
Yeah.
There's reference to the captain from the Bounty. It was a lot of captain references
there
throughout
were.
All of this episode. So I would say during this one, okay, so we had a lot of buildup towards Year of Hell because, of course, that Kes episode.
Yeah, before and after.
Before and after, it really actually hinted that the crew was going to go through a very tough time. And I think a lot of people kind of built it up before the writers were even ready to tackle this one. Because I remember Brendan Braga was doing, like, I think it was a Yahoo chat room session.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually asked him. I got to ask him a question about Year of Hell. And
yeah.
I was just like, were you foreshadowing when you were referencing it in Before and After? Or did you decide, or did Before and After inspire you to do it? And he's like, we're just kind of making it up as we went along. Like, we had no plans on doing any sort of Year of Hell thing. And then, yeah, we figured it might be the right time to do it.
Yeah.
So I was like, oh, okay. I uncovered a real nugget from the writer's room. I was very impressed. This, I think, was 13, 14-year-old Tyler.
Yeah. From what I read, it was the term Year of Hell is what really, like, jumped out at them from that episode. They're like, boy, that sounds like something. And it says, like, I don't know. There's a lot of conflicting reports, but there was rumors, at least nuggets, that say that there was at least very brief consideration, very brief, I think, in the initial planning of making a whole season around this. Which,
okay, so I don't know. No. I'm going to step back from that.
Yeah.
I don't think there's any veracity to that.
Okay.
I think what actually happened is there's the Ron Moore interview that he gave to Cinescape magazine.
Mm-hmm.
And Ron Moore is the one saying, no, guys, you should not have done a two-part episode around this. You should have done a full season all around this.
It was Kirsten Beyer that stated that. So I was like, I don't know.
I don't think so. Because I know this is, look, I'm already doing a Star Trek podcast, but I know it's geeky. I was running a Star Trek Voyager fan page at the time. For all those listeners at home, that's Janine Smith snorting at my geekiness at 13-year-old Tyler. I was following all the rumors, everything of the sort. So I know for a fact that really wasn't on the... sorry, Janine. That really wasn't on the table. It's really more something that Ron Moore had posited. And look, you know, 20 years later, Kirsten Beyer's maybe getting her you know, signals a little mixed up. I totally understand.
Yeah, it makes sense.
Yeah.
Because, you know, maybe we'll talk about it a little later, but maybe we could talk a bit about whether it would have worked as a season. But
Janine's, she's got tears rolling down her eyes laughing at Tyler's geekiness.
So, Janine, why don't we just jump over to you? You just watched Year of Hell.
I did.
What was your take on it?
I really enjoyed it.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay, we got you to watch The 37s. We got you to watch Message in a Bottle.
Yes.
Have you since watched any more Star Trek Voyager episodes since that Beginner's Guide to Star Trek that we got you to do in, like, I think July of 2017?
Right. Yesterday, I watched the two-part pilot.
Right. Caretaker.
Yes.
What did you think of Caretaker, though, as a way of, I guess, world-building, establishing the premise, etc.?
I thought it was really good to introduce to the characters. Right off the bat, Doctor's a hologram.
Right,
you
would have
figured that out much sooner had you watched the pilot. Yeah.
That really helped, but it could also have been that I'd seen some episodes prior, so I was looking for certain things to understand the characters. Paris is a creep.
Right.
Really?
That grossed me out.
Oh, yeah.
He was really uncomfortable.
Was he skeezy in that episode? I don't really have a lot of memories.
Yeah, when they're transporting him to the ship, there's a woman driving the ship, and he's like all over her, and he's like, "Ooh, I've never seen a captain like this before."
Oh, I remember.
It's just
Wait, was that in the shuttle?
Yeah. It's coming back.
Like
yeah.
on their way to DS9, I think, or something like that.
I don't know.
Okay.
I remember commenting on that on the one of us did on the podcast we did on Caretaker.
Yeah, Cam was like, "I like his
moves." It's really uncomfortable because she's
just trying to do her job.
She's not viscerally like, ew, go away, but you can see it's just
it has that like awkward professionalism where she's like, think about your job, think about your duty.
Yeah.
That's what makes it all the more awful.
And this climate right now,
right.
It really felt just
It is funny how like a movement like this can like the Me Too movement can just make so many things pop out of TV shows that no one had thought about in the you know weeks earlier.
I mean, it
is interesting.
I don't think that was ever okay.
Right. No, it never was.
But definitely like nowadays
it's more
just
at the forefront of people's minds now. But
it colored how I look at him moving forward.
Right. Yes.
So even in the episode. Okay. Is he supposed to be sexy? Do women find
that is an interesting question because it seems to be the case, yes.
Okay. Because I wondered with the Year of Hell how he's got like his robes open.
Right.
I was going to actually had that
kind
in my
of
notes. Yeah.
Playing it up like he's the sexy one, whereas Chakotay has it closed and.
Right. Chakotay not sexy. Is that what you're saying?
I think they both can be.
Yes.
Yeah.
If I had to pick.
Yeah, who did you find sexier?
I would say Chakotay's sexier.
Okay.
What is it? The tattoo?
That is the dumbest looking tattoo.
That's very offensive
seen.
To the rubber tree people.
I repeat, Cam, the rubber tree people.
Yeah.
He's not skeezy seeming.
Right.
Like I said, like watching that pilot and seeing that. I mean, there's 170 episodes still. I have
right.
164. I still have to go through.
Yeah.
So maybe my opinion of him will change, but
I think it will a bit. Yeah. I think you're that's one thing I'll say for Voyager is I think your impression of characters does change over time.
Let's get into Year of Hell though, Janine.
Yeah.
You enjoyed this episode.
Yeah.
Do you think were you lost throughout this two-part episode? We're gonna go tackle it, you know, episode by episode, but I just want your overall thoughts here.
Okay.
Is this like an okay episode for somebody who's not super familiar with the crew to kind of take it in as kind of a almost like a 90-minute sort of movie that you could kind of watch independent of your experience from the rest of the series?
I think so.
Okay.
Absolutely. I enjoyed it. The only character I wasn't familiar with was Seven.
Right.
Sure. Okay. But do you think she's kind of an iconic character in pop culture and that you at least recognized her?
Oh, she was the one I know. I remember girls in like grade 7, maybe.
Of 9?
pretending that they were her.
I did not go to the
Star
same
Trek.
High school as you did. No.
This is elementary school, my dear.
Okay.
Oh, well then.
So it's a little better. But yeah, so she definitely, even though I don't know the character, I know of her.
Yeah. So, Cam, your experience watching Year of Hell for the first time, was this an episode that had been built up to you? Were you? Did you go in with a lot of expectations, knowing how kind of, I guess, iconic this one is supposed to be?
I definitely had heard of this episode. Huh. And I think it largely had to do with, there's a panel in Star Trek in the Las Vegas Con every year that Jordan Hoffman puts on, voting for like the top 10 of things, whether it's best characters, best episodes. Best podcast host.
We've never made the top 10.
Not even in the 20.
No.
Not even under consideration. But he did a panel on the top 10, or it was like ranking the Voyager two-parters.
Mm.
And I remember him, or maybe it was just ranking the two-part. No, it was Voyager-centric. It was the Voyager anniversary year. And I remember he was ranking the best episodes of Voyager. That's what it was. That, I can clarify.
Are you sure?
Yes, I'm having a hallucination here. I'm going back in time to that point. Yes, it was the best Voyager
just
episodes.
Just like Anorax is going back in time.
I just want to see my wife again. But
well, you have a lock of her hair, man.
So basically he was doing a top 10 Voyager episodes, and the Year of Hell was near the top. And so I remember it really stuck in my head, the names of Year of Hell, Timeless, and The Killing Game. Like those three, maybe just the titles alone are really memorable, but they stuck in my head. So when I was working my way through Voyager, it was very clear, like, okay, I'm coming up to Year of Hell.
Your first watch,
yeah.
What was your reaction the first time you ever saw the episode?
I really enjoyed it a lot.
Yeah.
I was a big fan of it. I very much enjoyed the TNG two-parter, Best of Both Worlds, like everyone. And I think it's fairly safe to say everyone does for the most part.
What do you think of Best of Both Worlds, Janine?
I mean, it doesn't get better.
Yeah. It's the best.
This is the best.
It's the best.
But when I was going through a lot of the Voyager two-parters, a lot of them were really good. I thought Scorpion was a blast, and we reviewed that one not too long ago. But I think I actually may have preferred Year of Hell to Scorpion, if just a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Just a little bit. They were very close to me. But to me, this feels very much like it evokes that sort of Best of Both World. This is a movie, essentially. You know, not just a TV movie, because TV movie sounds kind of chintzy. It's like, this is a bigger than your normal TV movie. This is a real event.
So maybe we can get into it a little bit later on about Best of Both Worlds versus Year of Hell, or just how this stands up as a cohesive two-parter. But I would say right off the bat, I think it's very clear that one of the issues we often have with these two-parters is one part seems extraordinarily stronger than the other part.
Right.
And I think this is a fairly consistent two-parter. You know, from parts 1 to 2, you're clearly following multiple characters on an arc. There's a cohesive narrative that we're following as well. And I think this one holds up pretty well. Like,
yeah,
you know, 21 years later.
Right.
So I'm down with it. Why don't we just kind of get into the minutiae here? Talk about, let's start with part one, about like the highlights, what we're digging, why this one really stands up, you know, like 2 decades later, which is kind of an amazing thing. But Janine, for you, I mean, were you thrown off at all with, I guess, maybe the 90s storytelling / aesthetics? How does this one hold up for you as a viewer, you know, 2 decades after it premiered? Were you listening to, like, Everclear on the way here to get into that 90s mood at all?
It's Everlast, and it was 2000.
Oh, right.
I'll just
sorry.
To be accurate here. I honestly didn't feel it dated at all. I felt Discovery felt dated.
Mm.
So this to me
it's
felt
the exact same sort of VFX in Voyager as they do in Discovery at this moment.
Right.
So.
So in watching this, I was like, oh, okay.
Right.
It feels old anyway. And so, like, it feels old, not dated.
Kind of like how you can watch MASH nowadays, and it feels old, but, like, not dated. It's
right.
Like stories that still seem to resonate.
Yeah.
That's how I feel about Coach.
Did you ever watch the episode where they had 3D, like, episodes of Coach and 3D episodes of, like, Drew Carey, and you had to go to Wendy's to get 3D glasses?
Oh, I remember
I don't
that.
Remember if it's those specific episodes, but I remember other shows doing that. And I never had the 3D glasses for any of them.
I never had the 3D glasses, so I just watched like these 3D moments, and it was like, oh, this is stupid.
Yeah, I don't remember what the shows were, but I do remember other shows that I was very fixated. Or even, I remember they did a TV movie, Revenge of the Nerds 4, and it was in 3D. I never saw it in 3D. I'm sure it would have been great if I'd seen it in 3D.
Well, they should have made it Revenge of the Nerds 3.
Well, that was the next generation.
So, well, Cam, for you, I mean, like, how does one... Like, hold up. Let's get into the stuff that you really like from part one. We'll get to part two a little bit later on. But, I mean, what's sucking you in with regards to Year of Hell part one?
I think one of the things I really like about part one is that with the show Voyager, there was the sense that, like, this is a crew cut off from all their comforts, trapped in the Delta Quadrant, having to fight for their existence. And
And that's it.
Well, a lot of the time it didn't really feel like they had to do that very much.
They seem to have a very comfortable lifestyle.
Yeah, you would
Voyager.
Get, you know, two-parters like, say, Basics, or even an episode involving the Vidians, whether it's like, what's the one where Neelix loses his lungs? The Phage.
Spoiler
Isn't
for
the
me.
Phage?
Yeah. Yeah. You're correct.
Yeah, yeah. So you have like episodes like that that feel a little more extreme than your typical Star Trek stories, where it does feel like a crew that has to fight to continue on. But for the most part, there's a lot of episodes that, you know, don't really fall too much in that category, like when the Doctor's doing Beowulf, things like that. But to me, this felt like the prime example of what that sort of story should be, where it really is these characters getting pushed to the brink. And you see that a lot in part one, as, you know, they kind of stumble into the situation involving two alien worlds that are at war, which we've seen a billion times on Star Trek. And, you know, I don't think they take it that seriously. And we just see how that sort of situation removed from the safety of the Alpha Quadrant can lead to really grim things.
Well, let's talk about the characters being pushed to the brink. We see it with the Doctor very early on, I think within like the first 15 minutes, where he has to close the hatch on the people that are escaping from the turbo lift as the Deck 5 explodes.
Right.
We also have Chakotay. He goes to Janeway and he's like, look, why don't we just split up? Why don't we get in different shuttles as well as escape pods? Janeway makes the argument, you know, we're stronger together. And by the end of part one, she's like, no, let's separate. Where do you guys come down on this argument going on between Chakotay and Janeway throughout part one?
I agreed with her.
Okay.
I think at that point, it was stronger to stay together.
Because they're only, I think, like 47 days into this. It wasn't day 365.
Right.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, and she honestly felt that breaking apart, none of them had a chance. So why not stick it out?
But
give it a whirl.
I do like the fact, and I think, Cam, you've been a big proponent of this, and you're the one that really pointed out to me that Chakotay always seems to have way more to do in these two-part episodes than he does in just the regular, you know, episodic, you know, adventures that we have. And I like the fact that he's the one saying, hey, Catherine.
Yeah. They always have him disagree with her in two-parters.
Yeah.
It's really weird.
And I like Chakotay so much more in these two-part episodes than we do in the episodic ones, where he's just doing exposition, looking at his console, going on his spirit guide quests.
Yeah.
For this, I think it's a good argument for him to be bringing up. It's not quite the same as what we were, the conflict between them and Scorpion, where it's like, should we go through the Northwest Passage and, you know, risk the Borg and whatever these anomalies are, or should we just avoid it altogether? It's not quite as compelling, but it's still very interesting that, well, Chakotay doesn't even really seem to like his plan. He's like, yeah, you're right, Janeway.
Yeah, that's one thing with the scene. It's hard for me to argue for Chakotay's plan when Chakotay doesn't even seem to care that much about his plan.
He's like, yeah, you're right. It sucks. Let's not do it.
I would be interested to see how this scene would play out, you know, maybe 50 more days into the future.
Well, did you guys think it was weird that by the time we get to the end of, like, part one, Year of Hell had only gone on for about 2.5 months?
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, you get to the end of part two, and then it's like a full year.
Right.
Like, that seemed like a bit of a leap to me.
Right. Yeah, I don't think the time tracking is particularly spectacular.
So, guys, before I forget about this, though, but we had a bit of a wow moment during our viewing experience here.
Yeah.
In which, you know, I want to bring this up, and I think it is not, you know, just kind of like fun little trivia, but it is significant that Chakotay brings his pocket watch to Janeway.
Mm-hmm.
Happy birthday, Catherine.
Thank you.
Thank you. No, she doesn't say thank you. She's more like, F off.
Yeah.
But he says, it's May 20th, your birthday. And, you know, I don't want to date ourselves ever on this podcast.
Right.
But we are literally recording this episode. We're watching it all together on May 20th, 2018. And all of us went,
Total coincidence.
It was so exciting.
Yeah.
Nobody planned for that.
No.
But let's talk a little bit about kind of Janeway and Chakotay trying to keep each other human. I think this is a very big part of Janeway's arc throughout both parts of this two-parter.
Yeah, because you see that Chakotay is removed from the equation, and maybe that's why Janeway starts to fall apart a bit.
And also think about how, do you think Chakotay starts to fall apart?
Well, you know what? Let's get to that when we talk about part two, because I got a lot to say about Chakotay in part two.
I really did like the scene between the two of them on her birthday, where she is just being totally scientific, totally academic in her thinking, where it's, you know, no time for sentimentality. Like, we are in like a horrible situation. I appreciate the thought. I don't even know if she said that though.
Right.
No, you know, but it's kind of like
Picard would have said that. He would have been like, you know, I appreciate this, number one. But no.
Yeah. But to me, it's one of those things about this two-parter that really stands out to me. And also, do you think it's a bit of a coincidence that they're dealing with a time-traveling antagonist, and he gives her a pocket watch.
A little
on the nose.
It's sort of like in Star Trek 2, where he gives him the spectacles when Kirk's feeling old the whole movie.
Yeah. But it's our first reference to a wayward captain, because, of course, this is a replica. Was it the captain of the Titanic at this point that had this?
No, it was someone else.
Somebody else?
It was someone who brought the ship back into port with, like, a sail and, three boards.
Yeah, after eight months hitting a typhoon.
Yeah, a lot of nautical references in this two-part.
There are references to, like, four different, like, captains that went way off to sea and, you know, had horrible experiences.
If you're
going
to be on the nose, be on the nose.
Yeah.
They were not going to abandon, but, well, you know, let's go with that. They were not going to abandon the whole, like, captain going down with the ship sort of aspect or holding the crew together. They were going to hammer that home throughout.
Well, what I liked is with the whole Chakotay thing and her being very cold, it felt very awkward.
Right.
But what kind of I thought was neat, and this will, I'll touch a bit on the second part, was that she had to hold back her emotion because I think she would break.
Right.
And that's why the doctor, I think, misdiagnosed as TSD,
right.
traumatic stress disorder.
Yeah.
Because she was blocking her emotions.
Right.
And you saw that bit of a break when the Vulcan, what's his
Tuvok.
Name? When
Tuvok,
she
yeah.
hugged him, like, you saw her momentarily break.
Right.
And I think that was her way of getting through it, is to not let herself break.
Let's talk a little bit about Janeway in part one. You know, like, do you think she literally was going through psychological issues or, you know?
I mean, the question is, wouldn't anyone in this situation?
Who would have been in, like, the best state of mind to captain the ship, though? Do you think the ship would have been in any better state if, say, Tuvok or Chakotay had taken command in part one? I don't know. I don't think so. I think this is...
No.
No matter how much you could see this affecting Janeway, I think she was still the person to be leading the entire crew this entire time. Like, she was totally, you'd hope so, but invested in what was going on to the point, you know... small spoiler for the first 1 minute of part two, but she's demanding that the doctor injects her with that medicine that will allow her to breathe after sucking in all that nebula gas.
Right. So. Yeah, trioxin.
Yeah, Cam's been demanding that from his doctor. The doctor's like, I don't know what you're talking about.
I've had to go to like a dozen clinics. I'm on a watch list. But I want to talk a little bit, you know, we brought up Tuvok. Tuvok, Tyler, is a character that we kind of like to poke fun of on this podcast. He's a character who often does not deliver on screen. And I actually think Tuvok brings a lot in Year of Hell. And, you know, in part one, I think they find, you know, a very good pairing between him and Seven of Nine.
Absolutely, 100%. And it makes me all the more frustrated that we didn't really have this Tuvok-Seven relationship persist so much. There was episodes that they did have, or at least moments throughout the remainder of the series where, you know, they really do connect. This really should have been like the pairing throughout the series. Like they had,
they had to go with Neelix instead.
I know, but they had so much great chemistry together.
Yeah,
I love the fact that it's Tuvok helping Seven of Nine discover her humanity.
Yes,
because they're commiserating over the fact that humans are pretty hard to get along with.
Right.
I'm. Okay,
and you'd think
love
that someone
moments.
Like Seven of Nine would gravitate towards someone like Tuvok.
Yeah, I love these moments, but it bugs me in that like we never really get some satisfying follow up from an adventure that was wiped out from space and time. So what did you, Janine, think of the Tuvok 7 stuff that was going on?
I mean, until you guys start talking, I thought that that relationship was
pretty, like,
was sort of somewhat already established.
One of the
and
spines
then would
of the
continue
series.
On.
Yeah.
And it's a sign of how strong it is, I think, in this episode that you would just take for granted that, no, this must exist because it's really well written.
So then
it
why
makes
not
complete
follow
sense.
Up?
I don't know. Yeah. It's sometimes, you know, you can't see the forest for the trees. And maybe, you know, when they're shooting this, they're like, yeah, whatever, these two are fine together. But you know what? It'd be more interesting throwing, you know, opposites together like, you know, Neelix and Tuvok. Then you have more, quote unquote, drama.
Well,
you know,
maybe
of opposites.
Maybe in the long term, they didn't see a growth. They
maybe?
Just didn't see it.
Yeah.
You like to think that they sort of looked ahead and were like, you know what? We really don't see this being able to keep going. So what if we...
My best guess, though, is that... With regards to Seven of Nine, they really latched on to the Janeway relationship and the Doctor relationship. And with Tuvok, they never really seemed to care about him. So they're like, do we need to give Seven yet another important relationship?
Right.
Which, to me, is kind of to the detriment of the series.
Yeah, no, I agree. And not only to the series, but to the character of Tuvok, who I think really backslides.
I mean, his best, I guess, sparring partner was always Neelix.
Or Lon Suter.
Yeah, for his three episodes.
Yeah.
So I just felt as if Tuvok could have been so much better served if he had, you know, somebody to go back and forth with way more.
Right.
So, guys, let's talk a little bit about Anorax.
Yes.
I think this is a very important thing here, in which I actually... Okay, Cam. I'm thinking back to one of our TNG two-part episodes that we reviewed, Gambit, in which we have an antagonist.
Right.
Who...
The space pirate guy,
The space pirate guy. We don't even remember his name.
No.
We did not give a crap about him. He was incredibly boring. We also thought he was quite stupid.
Yeah, he had that control panel that could make people feel pain.
Yeah.
And no one took it from him.
Nobody went into his bunk while he was sleeping and stole it. Here's a character, and I think, you know, Chakotay describes in part two as an enlightened but misguided person. Did you guys find Anorax, I guess, sympathetic? And if you did, I guess I'm spoiling my own response. Yes, I found him sympathetic, but I wonder.
Tyler's been trying to erase timelines.
But I want, I know. There's so much stuff in my life I want to forget about. But I wonder if a lot of it was just from the performance of one Kurtwood Smith as well. Janine, what did you think about Anorax, I guess, motivation essentially, which is to recover his family?
I thought it was. I had a lot of sympathy for him. I think he's found himself in a spot where absolutely every weekend. I spend the rest of the week just trying to get my family back. Just to lose
them. I'm right here. You just won't return my text.
Well, it is the weekend.
That's true.
I will lose you by the end of the night.
We're literally recording this on a Sunday.
Yeah.
So it's not until the end of the weekend that you finally were able to recover, Cam.
I thought it was interesting that they kept Anorax's motivation fairly quiet through part one. Like, you know, there is that lock of hair, but you don't exactly know what he's up to. It actually reminded me, you know, we talked about the coincidence.
He's from the 1980s. He had a rat's tail that he wanted to keep.
He just wants to, he's like living in the past.
Yeah.
He's like Tom Paris. But it was, you know, just a coincidence too. You and I went and saw Deadpool 2 last night with the character of Cable, who has a very similar motivation as Anorax. And, you know, just like that, you know, like both characters keep their ultimate motivation secret for a lot of the story. And with Anorax, there's, I think it's just the character, you know, as played by Kurtwood Smith, there's more just shades of melancholy to that character. I mean, obviously Deadpool 2 has a very different tone than, you know, Year of Hell and the series Voyager.
Yeah.
But there's something much more, I think, melancholy carried by the actor, Kurtwood Smith. I don't know, especially in part one, if that's on the page, because Anorax doesn't have a lot to do, but the actor brings so much to the table.
I 100% agree with that. And that you think about Kurtwood Smith, like, I was most familiar with him from, say, that 70s show where he's playing a very intimidating father figure.
Or like RoboCop, where he's playing like a total psychopath.
But you know, I totally forgotten he was at RoboCop until, you know, like years later when I was watching, you know, like after this episode had aired.
Right.
So it was funny for me, like, watching him in part one, and I totally agree with you, Cam. Like, on the page, there wasn't much there.
In part two, there is, but in part one, not so much.
But for whatever reason, you're watching part one, you're like, I like this guy. He doesn't seem like evil for the sake of evil. Like, there must be a reason why he's going forward with what they essentially call out as genocide,
right.
Which I totally agree with, though.
But it's a type of genocide that you can understand from the point of view of a scientist. Like, to him, it's so clean and clinical that it doesn't have that sort of horror to it.
Yeah.
I can totally understand how he would be able to justify it to himself.
Well, Ginny, for you, what about his performance? You know, forget about the character. What about Kurtwood Smith's performance, at least in the first part of this episode? Like, were you kind of drawn in to a certain degree, or...?
Yeah, I mean, what I thought was really neat was, you know, you're saying he didn't have much to do in the first part, but I thought that really worked because it made you want to know more. Yeah. And he's such a good actor that even though there wasn't much on the page, you really felt that there was more to this character. So you really just wanted to keep moving to see what was going on.
So ultimately, by the time we get to the end of part one, they go through with Chakotay's original plan. Let's split up. How does this work as a cliffhanger, so to speak, for you guys? Because, okay, and I may be getting it wrong, but I think this actually aired when I first saw it, like, back-to-back. Like, it was like a full-length episode.
Okay.
And I could totally be mistaken. So it did not seem to me at the time as an obvious cliffhanger.
Right.
Even though it kind of seems very much that way in retrospect. But how does this work as a cliffhanger for you, Janine? Like, we're splitting the crew apart. Does it resonate for you at all emotionally?
No.
Because you've got your family back together because it's the weekend?
I feel great. Yeah. Well, to be honest, I looking back, I don't remember when the episode ended.
Okay. Right.
Just because we watched it all in a row and Fair it ran
together. It does feel
it
very
ran
seamless.
Together nicely.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't feel that there was sort of a heightened sense of stress.
Right.
When the crew split.
Mm.
I will say that it does work for me more so than a lot of the Voyager two-parters, which we've talked in the past how it doesn't feel like Voyager's engineering the end of their part ones to be these huge epic endings. Mm-hmm. It's more just like they're making these fairly seamless two-part episodes with a fairly clear split.
The Scorpion cliffhanger is pretty lame.
Sure.
Where, for anybody who doesn't recall, it's Voyager escapes with a Borg cube after a 8472 attack.
Yeah.
And the cliffhanger is Voyager going to be destroyed? I'm like, well, if that happens, then it's the end of the series. So, no, it's not going to be destroyed.
Right.
But in a situation like that, you really do have the crew splitting up. We have Chakotay and Tom. They're abducted. And Janeway finally says, look, guys, like, take off, get in your escape pods, get in your shuttles, try to find faster ships. We'll meet together at a certain point. To me, there was a certain emotional resonance to this because... like, Janeway's always been that, you know, I guess, like, dead mother.
Right.
And the fact that she is saying, oh, we've lost. Like, all I can really do is pursue forward with this hunk of metal as it is. And I want to save your lives as much as I can by spreading things out. To me, like, it was only after I watched this episode again that this cliffhanger actually really did stick out to me and really did resonate in just my own personal opinion.
I think it's because Janeway gives her, you know, that big speech about abandoning ship. And Kate Mulgrew just bites into it. Like, she is so good at these big dramatic scenes talking to her crew. She might be the best of any of the captains at these types of speeches.
I'm trying to think about, like, who else would be...
Archer, obviously.
I like Scott Bakula, but I actually think Archer is probably
not the emotion
least,
level, I think, with Archer's speeches.
Yeah, the least equipped to do that, any final thoughts on part one until we jump over to part two?
I got a
two?
Couple little fun things I wanted to mention.
Okay.
Just a side one. At the very start of the episode, the doctor wants to give a speech talking about, you know, the dedication of the crew as they're commemorating the new mapping area of Astrometrics. And he starts going on about how, you know, when we first began as a crew, we were fighting with each other, we were scrapping, and I was like, where was that show?
I know. Like, I only wish there was more conflict.
Yeah, no kidding. I was like, I don't recall that at all. They got along together pretty well. But the second one was, there's this extended scene where Kim and B'Elanna Torres are trapped and, you know, playing this game of trivia to keep each other entertained. And he's asking her, like, trivia questions to name B-level Hitchcock movies. And I was sitting there thinking to myself, who in the 24th century would be remembering, like, To Catch a Thief? And look, I like To Catch a Thief. I have it on Blu-ray. But in the realm of Hitchcock movies that are likely to be remembered, you know, 400 years from now, it's not high on the list.
You mean it's like if we're trapped in an elevator doing trivia on some of Shakespeare's crappiest sonnets?
Yes.
We're like, I don't know. Like, he did some good sonnets.
Sure.
He did some fantastic plays.
Yeah.
But what if we're quizzing each other on his B-list sonnets?
Or I was just like, asking you questions about Henry the Sixth.
Yeah.
You'd be like, you mean the fifth? No, no, the sixth.
No, but for me, when he was asking those questions, I just thought, oh, he's a Cameron.
Thank you.
Because that did not faze me in the slightest.
Right. Even though they're in the 24th century?
I grew up with those questions.
That's true.
And it's true. Like, who does know and why do these matter? Somebody cares. And he is sitting to the left of me.
So wait, who is right, Cam? Was it Cary Grant?
Yeah, it's Cary Grant.
Yeah.
I was going to try and do a Cary Grant impression, but I can't.
That's what I was trying to get you to do.
Yeah, I can't at all. All right. But no, I thought, you know, I think this two-parter is considered like a very serious 2 hours of TV, but these do bring lighter moments to the episode. It doesn't, it's not all kind of this funeral dirge of an episode.
So guys, let's jump over to part two, and we find ourselves 2 months later.
Yeah. How do you feel about the time shifting? Because I kind of briefly touched upon earlier.
I do feel conflicted with it because we find out that Chakotay and Tom Paris have been in like solitary confinement for 2 months, which that would make anyone go insane, would it not?
Yeah.
Like, have they not seen Papillon? He's like eating centipedes in his room.
Yeah.
But that
would have been a great scene.
Like, why are there centipedes in here?
No, they're all the last centipedes from like one particular planet.
Flash. They keep disappearing.
Yeah, he tries to get them in the mouth and like they just like vanish. Yeah. So this seems like torture.
Right.
And then we find Chakotay is very much just, I guess, bedazzled by what Anorax is all about here, which I find very curious, very interesting, but I do like how it brings up conflict between him and Tom.
Yes.
But I kind of think that they're both right, but they're also both wrong. I think there's like a good balance you could find between the two of them about just being, neither one of them seems to be practical about what's happening right here.
Right. Now, I am curious, Janine, you know, you don't have sort of the background in watching these two characters that Tyler and I have. You haven't sat through 170 hours of watching these two characters. What was your takeaway on Tom versus Chakotay in this conflict?
I honestly didn't have much invested in it.
Now, who did you think came across as more rational?
Yeah.
I thought Chakotay came across as more rational.
It's because you find him a little sexier. Well,
And that's how I make my decisions. Yeah. I don't. It made sense to me that he felt that he could. Because you did see some, you know, human in Anorax.
Yeah.
So you could kind of understand, like, you know, maybe he's like, well, if I can make the science work, he's receptive to that. Anorax.
And the fact
he's
that he's
not
saying
closed off and like, no, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
I'm going to keep on this path. Like, he seemed open to that resolution. So I could understand Chakotay being like, no, if I can do this, he'll go with it.
And the fact that he's saying, you know, I can make this asteroid disappear, which is a very, like, that's not wiping out an entire race. It's kind of like Silver Surfer guiding Galactus to, like, barren planets versus inhabited planets, you know? It's like, well, look, this being is going to do bad things, but if I can guide him, maybe I can, you know, diminish the casualties.
That part of the asteroid was a little weak.
Yeah.
Just that whole, like, there are simpler ways to explain the butterfly effect.
Sure.
Like, he was like, little bits of this have broken off and fed civilizations.
Yeah.
And you're like, what are you talking about? And then, you know, time is past, present, future.
Right.
And he's like, getting all like touching his heart. And that was a bit heavy-handed, but
heavy-handed.
If Paris and Chakotay had to settle their differences the old-fashioned way,
who
do
you
guys
think would win? I know who I would vote on.
I've never seen either of them fight.
Okay,
there's actually an episode called "The Fight."
Yeah,
I will not spoil who stars in that episode.
Well, okay, Cam, let's dish our... I would think Chakotay would win in a fight versus Tom. What about you, Cam?
Yeah, Chakotay, I think, has, you know, he's got boxing training.
Exactly.
Oh, I see. I would think he would just say level-headed. Paris seems very reactive, and I think he would just sort of be all over the place.
Yeah.
Tom Paris is considered, like, the bad boy of the series.
Janine, you laugh, but we literally did an episode called The Bad Boys of Star Trek, and
he was the number one bad boy.
He was the number one bad boy.
That's just...
Period.
I feel like I really don't understand the attraction of some of these men, and because I didn't get the Bashir thing,
right?
I don't get. Isn't that guy from Archer's the captain?
Yeah.
Trip Tucker. Yeah.
Right? No.
Really? Okay.
No.
Right.
I don't understand any of these
men are very popular amongst our friend circle. You know. So,
and not just our friend circle, you go to the conventions.
Yeah.
There are screams.
But what about Riker?
And that's
like,
just Tyler.
Cam, we were talking about this after Deadpool. Like, we went out for dinner,
yeah.
And we're talking about like how many of our friends we know that are just like enamored by Riker. I'm just wondering about your thoughts about one Riker, Janine. Like, do you find him sexy?
No.
Very much like Rod Stewart would sing to the ladies.
Sexy. No.
Okay.
I'm trying to rack my brain to think if there is a Star Trek.
Rack your brain.
I'm trying.
Oh, jeez.
I just feel like that's not okay. I'm trying to think if there's a character
somewhere.
Now,
who's the sexiest like Star Trek character in your opinion?
Oh, God.
Would it be in the new movies like Chris Pine?
Yeah, but that feels like a cop-out
to me.
Yeah,
it does.
Right?
Yeah.
Because then I would say Carl Urban.
Sure. Vintage Kirk?
Maybe.
I would say like maybe Vintage Kirk.
That's where I first went was Vintage Kirk.
Okay.
What about for you, Cam? Sexiest character? Is it Kira for you?
I think so.
Okay.
I think so, yeah.
Seven might be though.
No.
Though they did try pretty hard with that outfit.
They try really
hard.
Tight. I think that's why they try so hard.
But what I like is that it is still full coverage.
Right.
And she's still pretty.
Yeah,
she's badass.
She is. She
anyway,
is.
Anyway, so.
I like that they don't make Seven ever feel like this character that kind of have to carry along. Like, she's ahead of the curve on a lot of the characters.
Yeah.
And I think that pays off in this two-parter as well.
So.
But, you know, getting back to, sorry, the.
want to commit to who's your sexiest Star Trek character.
No, I said Kira, I think.
Okay.
I think Kira's. I guess, do you want to give yours, Tyler?
Oh, yeah, Harry Kim.
Okay, well, that makes sense. The character most like yourself. Okay.
We do love the clarinet.
But, you know, getting back to the Tom Paris and Chakotay
on
Anorax's ship, do you think that paid off sufficiently? Like, would you have liked to have seen more of a conflict between these two characters?
Well, I feel like everything with Chakotay would, like, rise up and then just fall.
Right.
Right? Like, his, not confrontation with the captain, but when he's like, I think we should, you know, abandon ship. And she's like, no. And he's like, you're right.
Yeah.
And then with Tom Paris, he's like, you just stand down and da-da-da. And then like a beat later, he's like, you keep working on it. You get those codes.
He does back down a lot.
It just felt very, there was, the rise and fall was instant.
But I think he's picking his battles.
But he didn't pick a battle.
Yeah.
He didn't feel fully
committed to anything.
So it's, I mean, especially I don't have a history with him.
Right.
It's really hard for me to put any stock in anything he says when he's very quickly just sort of like, eh.
Well, get ready for another 170 episodes of that.
I had a question. This is for Janine. Now, Janine, there is a scene early in part two where Anorax has dinner with Chakotay. And then Tom Paris. Did this not feel like a Bond villain dinner?
It really did. He's like, come on in.
I've got delicacies.
This wine is the last of its kind.
Yes.
But what I also found amusing is how he's saying, like, these are the last delicacies of the worlds I've destroyed. And it's literally like a sliced up baguette and a bowl of olives.
Yeah,
like there were some definite like
they were a simple culture.
There were some other things that you're like, I don't know what that is, but that's all I could see is he said that, and I was like, that's a baguette.
He's not an anthropologist.
You know that the people the people with props that week were just like running to the grocery store next door. They're like, we need something we can use for alien food.
Yeah, what do you think? Like every replica or remnant of every civilization that they captured was food related.
Yeah.
Like it was not artwork. It was not music. It was a baguette.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah. That you could eat and that was it. It's gone.
Yeah. Well, you know what? You know, this is a true life story. Like I have made food for several TV shows and that, you know, the way this works is they just, you know, send it out to other places that make food. And there's like, can you prepare something? and we just do it. Yeah. And so what we're giving them, they'll wind up using it. You know, I've made quote unquote homemade cookies, home baked cookies for, I think it was Arrow. You know, it's like, so I'm sure they were just like sending an order out.
Were these Arrowroot cookies?
Oh, Jesus. Oh, you know, so they just get their, you know, production assistant to swing by, you know, a food store and be like, we need some food that looks kind of alien. Can you just put something together? So, you know, I think the baguette kind of sums that up.
But touching on the bonding. Yeah,
alien baguette.
It did feel very Bond villain because yes. He
even had
kind
like the jacket.
He was kind of about world domination too, yep. Right? And then he...
Very sophisticated and rational sounding.
The two prisoners or whatever he took, he gives outfits to.
Right.
They have their own quarters.
Yeah.
And then he even says at one point, he's like to Paris, he's like, I'm going to keep you as comfortable as possible. And that's very Bond villain.
Right.
To be like, I'm going to give you everything you want so that you start to see things from my perspective.
And it felt like Tom Paris was being written in the role of like the Bond girl character.
Oh, yes.
Who would be the one that would lash out.
With the sexy low cut.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Whereas like Chakotay was the Bond guy who's like the Tom Paris character is removed. He's the one like, okay, and goes back to talking to the villain very, you know, like two dueling wits with, you know, one another.
Yeah.
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 I thought that was really, really pronounced. And, you know, there's a lot of Bond homages throughout Star Trek, but this one to me felt really, really like obvious.
Well, and just how he was like pouring the wine and over explaining it and then just kicking
back. It's almost like he wants to brag. He's just like, look what I got. Isn't it cool?
And then just kicking back and sort of like watching them.
Yeah.
Like, here, I've laid everything out. I've laid all my cards on the table, if you will. Let's see what you're going to give me.
Well, Tom and Obrist did play that board game later on.
That looked fun.
Well, what did you guys think of Anorex? And we find out by episode two that he believes that time itself is waging a war against him.
I mean, don't we all feel that way?
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
I'm aging by the day, Tyler. Time is the fire in which I'm burning.
Well, that, okay, you bring that up, and I was thinking like Star Trek Generations, Star Trek Generations. This is a weird obsession with Star Trek.
Yeah. Done well, though.
But they're both Brandon Braga scripts, Generations as well as Year of Hell. So you kind of think that, what does this reveal about Brandon Braga's own psyche?
Not only that, but he wrote Generations before he wrote this episode, right? Do you think this was him trying to do that right?
Yes, I absolutely do, because I think he's the first to admit that Generations was a bit of a misfire.
Yeah, we should say it's Dr. Sorn is the character we're talking about.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so with this, okay, let's take a step back and see how we can really gauge the way that time can be like an enemy. It's not manifested in any physical sense, except that we do have those, well, 2D... shockwaves, which honestly, if time was changing, I don't think it would just be through 2D shockwaves. I think these would be three-dimensional, like spherical shockwaves.
Sure.
That's just my hunch.
Well,
yeah. Okay. But so we have this, and I think it's really, I think it's a very good point that you bring up. Is it Brandon Braga trying to figure out, like, hey, maybe this is a far more intriguing, far deeper way of attacking this whole, I guess, time situation? Because here's the thing. At the very beginning of part two, it's like, hey, we've been doing this for 200 years. That's what Anorex says to Obrist. And look, don't sweat it. We've got all of eternity to get it, not just 98% restoration, but 100% restoration to retrieve Anorex's family at this point. So, guys, can I briefly segue into Obrist and his arc? In like, I'm intrigued by these kinds of characters. We've seen them in Nemesis with, say, the Viceroy. We see them in Insurrection with, I guess, the henchman next to the Sona Ruffo.
Very memorable character.
Very well, but it's the same sort of thing where it's like the main villain, main antagonist's kind of sidekick is the one who's having second thoughts about this plan.
The henchman.
I thought like Obrist was an interesting character, and I liked how conflicted he seemed to feel after 200 years of doing this thing. So I totally understand his motivation throughout this.
Does this ship ever have shore leave?
Well, that's okay. I put a note in the fact that these gents were wearing identical uniforms, both Anorex as well as Obrist, which means they've been wearing these same outfits for 200 years.
Right.
Would you not get sick of it? Would you actually want to wear the same uniform
Maybe
for 200
years?
Maybe
they did, though. We were only with them for a year. Maybe they did change up their outfits.
Oh, so yeah. So maybe like a year ago, they actually did change it up. Okay. So yeah.
Anorax gets creative once a year.
They've got a seamstress somewhere on that ship.
It wouldn't have been super awkward if it was actually the last like outfit from a particular civilization and they're all like wearing them and it disappeared and they ended up naked like at a certain point. Awkward. Yeah.
I would have liked more just detail given to the potential mutiny on this ship. Because
one Captain Bree, right, as they say.
Sure. Blythe. But Blythe. I would like you're still thinking of the cheese on the table, Tyler.
I know. I'm munching on
Blythe. But I would like
Captain Bree.
I would have liked more.
No, I'm thinking back to that dinner that they had
that's
with
what I
Chakotay.
Said.
Yeah,
okay. The baguette.
You're like Bree would be really good on that baguette. But I really would have liked more to do with just like some of the other crew members. I would have loved to have heard what some of the other crew members are saying on this ship because. I mean, that's quite an operation to keep going for 200 years without a rebellion.
Yeah.
And at a certain point, Anorax is sounding a little bit like a madman. You know, you've got the captain of the ship running around saying, time's turned on me, and that we need to get 100%.
Which is another Star Trek trope that we've fallen back on with Captain Ahab, Captain Nemo, Captain Bly.
Right.
Or Bree.
Or Bree. Yeah.
Bree's the unknown captain, but, you know, the lesser known.
Yeah. So it's kind of evoking something we've seen many a time on Star Trek. Which,
sure.
Okay, I get it.
Fine. Was he the white whale that Janeway was chasing the whole time? Anorax?
So was Voyager the white whale, or was Anorax's ship the white whale? Who? Okay, because I do
I
like
thought time was the white
but,
whale.
But what about the parallels between Anorax and Janeway, in which these are two very determined captains, and to the point that both their crews think, maybe there's something wrong with them. Maybe we need to intervene. And we had the doctor try to, like, strip her of her command, and Janeway was like, yeah, good luck. What are you going to do about it, buddy?
Right. And they're both trying to fight to save their loved ones.
Well, okay, so their first and only encounter was on the view screen, in which Anorax says, well, unfortunately, only one of us is going to get home here.
Right.
Good luck with that. And it looks as if, well, I guess they both kind of succeeded to a certain degree.
Yeah, so in your face.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Janeway took the long route, but yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so, I mean, it works out okay for them.
Well, for me, like, one moment that I really want to highlight here is when they form the coalition with the other aliens, and Tuvok and Janeway have that goodbye. And to me, I was a sucker for that scene. I really, really loved it. Just even when the music was, you know, hitting its crescendo. And
right.
I'm not usually like kind of the mopey sort of person, but like this one really got to me. Like this one, I was like, I totally believed that these two characters truly care for each other.
Right.
They've gone through a year of hell together.
Sure.
And this is their parting, departure.
Not only that, but we've seen, you know, Tuvok is now blind from the accident in the Jeffries tube.
What a throwaway that was, though.
I know. Originally, he was supposed to lose his legs, and they were inspired by Forrest Gump. They wanted to do, like, a
Captain Dan.
It just seemed like that flash. And you were
Lieutenant,
like,
Dan.
Lieutenant Dan. Yeah, Lieutenant Dan.
And you were like, did they die?
You're on your captain fixation.
And then it cuts to him shaving. And at first, I'm like, he looks weird, just because he's staring oddly, but it's a broken mirror, and he's using a straight razor, so I'm like, okay.
Yeah, they
but
still use those in the 24th
throwaway.
Century.
There seemed to be no, I don't know.
It didn't feel like they exploited
like,
what they could have done with that sort of
did he go blind?
Limitation he had. Yeah.
None of them have any burn marks.
Well, Janeway did at a certain point.
No, Janeway, yes. Yeah. But Seven didn't really. She had maybe a little something on her cheek. But I'm like,
it's like Hollywood grease.
How did he go blind?
Yeah.
I think the fire hit his eyes.
Sure.
And didn't burn anything else. He still got his eyebrows.
Well, he did have sort of like light scarring.
No, he didn't.
He's
Vulcan.
We watched it in standard res.
Yeah, exactly.
High res, he would have had scars all over his face.
Did you want to see him go full out Geordi LaForge, kind of as an acknowledgement of his, you know,
Know who Geordi LaForge is.
Wow. So for listeners, Cam had to motion the visor over his eyes for Janine. Janine was not impressed with that little helpful hint.
I didn't know. We just did the beginner's guide.
And that makes me kind of think, okay, maybe they didn't show the part in the sick bay where he was getting his eyes and
right.
Okay. So maybe I'm being a little hypersensitive.
We only have so many moments. Yeah.
But it just felt kind of, I don't know. There were some moments in this that definitely felt a little like skipped over. And that was one for me. Another one is going back to Oberst.
Yeah.
I want to call him Oberweiss for some reason. Right. Oberst in Paris is suddenly when Paris is like, I think I can get him to flip. I was like, I have seen nothing that would make me think that he would flip. So I felt
they played a board game together.
Well, I felt, but that's where I felt like that relationship could have been a little bit more fleshed harvested.
Yeah. I agree. Yeah. But I will say one thing about the Tuvok injury too. I agree with you. I think there could have been a little more there. I would have loved to see, you know, we see throughout this episode how much Tuvok means to Janeway. And it would have been interesting to have this moment where she has that realization of like what's happened to her best friend in this conflict.
He's her best friend?
Well, he might be.
I think so.
Yeah.
Okay. I think they are best friends.
Yeah. Like, I would have liked to have just had a little bit of an acknowledgement there of just like, oh my God, this war's taking a toll. Like, a scene where maybe she just looks in his direction or something.
Do you think that moment was their departure scene?
I think so. But you could have done it earlier when he's actually injured. It would have, I think, touched a little more on how much that injury had impacted him.
I think it would have been powerful to have seen those little moments with her realizing as people got injured or people died.
Yeah.
Like, see that little bit of humanity in her.
Mm-hmm.
Just little tiny flashes of it as these things happen.
But I love, though, the moment when she does embrace him, you know, and you, as you said, like, she kind of breaks a little bit there. And you look at what has happened before that, where she's had, like, scarred lungs, you know, and then as well, she's, like, gone into the fire with the, like, be
with
kind.
The shield, yeah.
Yeah, which is such a badass Janeway moment. You know, you're thinking when she goes in, it's going to be kind of like one of those TNG episodes where, like, Riker runs into a burning room or something where it's pretty mild. And then they, like, show her, like, burnt laying on the ground.
Yeah.
And it shows, like, it's very serious. Like, everything she's going through is pretty horrific. And, you know, a lot of ways she's going through more horrors than the rest of the crew are, except for maybe those two people locked out in the exploding section. But
so, well, theirs was pretty quick.
Yeah, that's true.
That brings me, I guess, to my next question here, though. Janine, as you're watching this, at what point did it become clear to you? Okay, the ship is damaged beyond repair.
Oh,
yeah.
Like, did you think they were going to have to hit the giant reset button at a certain point? Or do you think that there is going to be a multi-episode arc where they rebuild the ship? What did you think the inevitability of this story arc was going to be here?
I figured out pretty quick that they were somehow going to get turned back in time.
Like time travel.
Yeah. But even, like, I figured out pretty early, pretty much as soon as you knew what the bad guy was doing, is that he was just turning back time.
Mm-hmm. There's a song about that. There's our exit music for this episode. Yeah.
But I still really enjoy...
Is that Wilson Phillips?
No, it's Cher.
Yeah.
Oh, is
How
it?
How dare you.
Yeah.
Okay. But I still...
Isn't her last name Phillips?
No. I still really enjoyed the journey.
Right.
Like, even though early on I was like, okay, well, obviously they're not all going to die. You know, obviously this isn't the end of the ship.
Or that Tuvok's going to be blind for three seasons.
Tuvok, well, I didn't know that.
Right.
That could have happened.
That's true.
But I didn't care that I knew the outcome. I was interested and excited to know how they were going to get there.
I'll say, when I wrote a review of this episode for my Star Trek Voyager fan page back on Angel Fire in 1997, I did complain a lot about how by the end of the episode, everything worked out.
Right.
And because the other thing that they'd really had emphasized in Before and After was that the crew went through this journey. They all recalled what happened.
Yeah.
It was a horrible experience, very traumatic, and it stuck with them. And then nobody here, like, whatever character arcs experiences happened, nobody had any recollection of it. So you kind of have to ask yourself, what does it all really amount to? We see what the crew is capable of, but for them going forward, it doesn't really have any impact on them.
I mean, yeah, I agree. Like, it would be kind of cool if maybe, like, say, Janeway had some sort of memory or something, like some sort of glimmer of, like, almost like recognizing something when she, you know, when the member of the Kremlin species shows up on the view
Krenim.
Screen. Or, Krenim, sorry.
Kremlin, they're the ones in
the Russians. But yeah,
you're
Krenim.
Still fixated on the Bond dinner.
Yes, I am. Yeah. But had, like, there been like a glimmer of recognition, but I'm totally okay with it because I think what ultimately this two-parter does is show me like what Janeway will go through. Like, it's more for the viewer than for the characters. And I'm okay with that. Like, it totally is satisfying to me. And I mean, it does give Janeway one of her most badass moments ever with the time's up, you know, and crash a ship. Now, Tyler, you and I talked about that, I think, in our most iconic episodes, part one, I think it was. But Janine, what was your take on that moment?
I mean, it's just, those moments always make me laugh.
Right.
Does it feel very 1980s to you?
But they still do that in movies and stuff. Like where they have that last 1 minute line that sort of summarizes everything that's going on and then boom. I enjoyed it. I didn't think that's how it was going to end.
I kind of love it. I think it's pretty good.
I enjoyed it. The time's up was a bit like, oh, come on.
I enjoyed it far more the second time I watched the episode than the first time. The first time I was just like, really? This is how it ends?
You know who it reminded me a lot of, actually, is Kirk in the Doomsday Machine.
Okay.
Yeah, crashing the Constellation ship.
She was not nearly as sweaty as when Captain, what's-his-face was.
Matt Decker.
She was not nearly as sweaty as when Matt
No,
Decker.
She was not.
That's too bad.
The one thing that took away from that moment for me is she, you know, you had the whole time's up and explosion, and then it cut to them on the ship.
Right. Like, it would have been better if that was the reset moment.
Everything just would have exploded.
Yeah.
And reset, as opposed to them being like, the tractometer or whatever is not working. Like, that to me took away from the power of the moment.
Right.
So, Cam, I don't know. Maybe we can dive into this later on in this week's video that we'll post on YouTube. But
sure.
And I know this is all news to you, but one thing maybe I'd like to discuss on YouTube is like most iconic episodes in Star Trek. You just mentioned iconic moments. Do you think Star Trek Voyager's Year of Hell is that series' most iconic episode within fandom? Do you think an argument could be made?
I think it's that.
Do you think it's that or Scorpion?
Scorpion.
Okay.
Yeah.
Why don't we leave
it
there?
Off the top of my head, yeah, like maybe that's a future episode or something.
Let's leave it there and maybe follow up in the video.
Sure.
I'd recommend everybody come follow us. Just type in Subspace Transmissions on YouTube. And why don't we tackle all of the series so far?
Sure.
And we'll do it a little bit, you know, kind of lightning round sort of style. But
sure.
The most iconic episodes from every respective series.
Sure.
Guys, do we have any kind of final thoughts on this one here?
I have a thought.
Yeah.
Okay, the hair.
Okay.
That bothered me the whole time.
Right. Janeway's hair or?
No, the lock of hair.
Okay.
His wife's lock of hair.
Yeah.
Was that little glass thing he kept it in, was that actually fighting off time?
Yeah.
Because if he wiped her out, that hair would be wiped out, right? Because she's wiped out of history. She never existed.
Right.
So that hair, theoretically, can't exist.
You see,
but then it's in this glass thing.
But not only
when it breaks, then it disappears.
But not only that, but the ship like exists in like some temporal. I feel like they could always explain. It's like, well, the ship's in temporal flux.
Yeah. How come the ship is protected, but her lock of hair is not protected?
Yeah.
That's kind of silly.
Yeah. That's where I get a little confused.
Yeah. They're all able to eat the food.
So
yeah.
I wasn't the only
like
one.
Like the food
confused.
Is still there. So then the hair would still be there, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So I
yeah, that is true. The food shouldn't be there.
Yeah.
Because they were wiped out.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think it's
so
just because the ship is in temporal flux.
I'm just pulling at a thread that I should leave.
Yeah.
Or a hair.
Now, I am... Oh, boy. I am curious. What did you guys think of the ending, giving Anorax a maybe happy ending? Maybe?
My thought is that this guy, like Janeway, is determined at whatever task he pursues.
Yeah.
I think it's just... It's going to reset itself. Like, he's still going to be pursuing this technology. I don't think it's a happy ending at all. I think it's actually a very ominous sort of ending for him. Just looks like the Voyager crew got far enough away that it's not going to affect them going forward.
Right.
What about you guys?
Yeah, I felt the same way because, I mean, why would his behavior change? Like we said, like, everything's wiped out. There's no memory of the events that just happened. So why would he suddenly become a different person?
Yeah, he's not going to learn anything from it.
Yeah.
No. Yeah. I mean, I think the first time I watched it, I took it as more of a happy ending. The second time, though, I was like, I don't really think this is... I don't think old Anorax is going to, you know, carve a new path.
Well,
here.
They try and hint at it, right? Because
right.
he eventually does put down his iPad or whatever.
Right.
And go off with her. But it's just that.
But
whole
he's still
point
working
that.
On that
he's
sort of stuff.
He's still working on it. He's still very insistent.
And he's a scientist, so like a scientist is going to be really fixated on trying to solve the problem
right.
they're invested in.
He doesn't
in.
Know what the outcome of it is yet.
Yeah.
So why would he just suddenly be like, you know what? I'm just going to enjoy sunny days now.
Right. Because what is he going to do then? Just sit out in the sun every day?
Yeah. Like yeah. hang out? No.
What happens when it rains?
I mean, yeah. And the question
like
is
like that garbage song.
The question is whether or not the outcome of his research is going to be the same as it was last time.
Right.
Or whether or not somehow, you know, it'll be different moving forward.
Yeah. No, that's a good point. So, you know, just final thoughts. Should we start, Janine? Final thoughts on the Year
does,
of Hell.
Yeah, Janine, does this episode justify itself as a two-parter?
Yeah.
I think so. I really enjoy. I would have gone with a three-parter.
Oh, yeah.
You know, because there was definitely some parts I would have liked
to Cam just
to
passed
seen.
Me a note and said it could have been a five-parter.
Wow. Do you think it would have worked as a full season?
It would have had to been more of a, like, intermediate steps taken as they have their own kind of episodic adventures, but we do get the sense that things are getting worse and worse as they go through Credim space. Mm-hmm. But I think the sense that I got from Before and After is that it didn't have to do with all this, like, sort of time travel-y voodoo that we experienced
right.
here. It was more like, hey, this is what happens when you experience enemy territory and things go to S.
Right.
So that's kind of my thought. What about you, Cam?
I think it would have, but you would have liked the Zindi War. You have to have some diversion episodes in there because
yeah,
I think it would
yeah.
have been pretty grim.
Like North Star.
Yeah.
the Cowboys.
Yeah. To have 26 episodes that are just really, really like, just things getting worse and worse.
Like this for an entire season.
Yeah,
like, this is a very
punishing.
Dark, very bleak,
yeah, just
as you
I,
say, punishing episode. You know,
there was talk about how they wanted to extend Time's Arrow, the TNG two-parter, where they go back to old San Francisco into like four or five episodes or something. It was, or maybe even longer. But like to me, that you can't stretch because just having that tone forever would feel weird. Having this tone, this grim tone, would also to me get to be a little bit overwhelming. But, you know, Janine, you know, ultimately Year of Hell. This is the, I guess, the second Voyager two-parter you've watched. What's your takeaway?
I liked it. I mean, I'm gonna trudge on mm-hmm. and see about getting through the entire series. And this definitely gave me hope for quality staying high as you get to third or fourth season.
Voyager's
whatever this was.
Mixed,
so.
But yeah.
Okay, well,
there's good, there's good,
for,
well, there's good
thanks
stuff
for
throughout.
Taking my, no, my hope down a peg.
What I mean is there's good stuff throughout. Like, you don't yeah. have to build to a season or anything.
Okay,
yeah.
Right. Yeah, so I really enjoyed it.
Mm-hmm.
I enjoyed it more than the pilot.
Okay, well,
okay.
That's
interesting.
Good.
And by pilot, you mean Tom Paris.
Well, yeah, the pilot. And it probably is my favorite out of, I mean, I've only seen six episodes, but probably out of the six I've seen.
Okay, interesting.
It's my favorite.
Yeah, for me, this lands pretty high up on my Voyager rankings. I think there's maybe, you know, one or two episodes, three episodes that I might hold higher. But this one, for me, is pretty high up on Voyager. I think it would probably be, you know, gun to my head or phaser to my head. If you asked me which is my favorite Voyager two-parter, I think this is probably it.
Interesting. Okay.
It's between that or Scorpion for me, and I think I would probably come down on this one for consistency.
Not Endgame?
No. I'm not as down on
not
Endgame.
Not Unimatrix 01?
No.
Okay.
No. There's some other good ones, but
yeah. I mean,
yeah.
For me, I think this one has actually aged better than my first viewing. I just remember first time I saw it, I was not nearly a big a fan just because of the whole reset button.
Right.
But I remember rewatching it fairly recently because of our blogs we were doing for Star Trek Discovery, and I was comparing this to, I think it was Despite Yourself? I
think so, yeah.
So I tackled that one there.
Yeah.
And I actually thought it had aged quite well over the years, most notably in the VFX and how they're far superior to the VFX that we're witnessing in Star Trek Discovery right now. For
which is
whatever
so
reason.
Weird, but yeah,
absolutely bizarre. So,
okay, so I think on that note, our assignment is complete. Jump on over to our Facebook page at facebook.com/subspacepod. We'll have the video that Tyler referenced earlier in the episode up, as well as discussion on Year of Hell. Tyler, what are we doing next week?
We're gonna take off from Star Trek Voyager and stick around in the Delta Quadrant. We're gonna take an examination of some of the notable aliens on Star Trek Voyager that were a lot of fun, but maybe we didn't spend as much time with them. And I think it's gonna be quite intriguing to think about the DQ aliens we would like to spend more time with, Cam.
Finally, a tribute to the Malon.
I love it. You joke, but not really, and nor do I. I do want to spend some more Melon time.
Okay, so you can also find us on the Twitter. I'm at Cam V as in very good Bree Smith.
I thought you were going to say Cam V Smith. Smith as in Kurtwood Smith.
No.
No. Okay.
It's all about the Brie on a baguette, preferably.
I appreciate that. You can find me at Reportin. That's REPORTT as in timeline, O-N.
Okay. And Janine, are you on the Twitter?
No.
Okay.
Well, I am, but just to read other people's tweets.
Okay. Well, thanks for coming on anyway.
Thank you, Janine. It was great having you back on the show.
Thanks, guys.
Okay. So until next time, the arena is closed.
Transfer complete.